Hello and welcome to Business Without Bullshit. We're here to help founders, entrepreneurs, and business owners navigate the modern business world. And we do this by telling the real life stories of leading figures and industry professionals to show that there are many others who share the same challenges in business and from whom we can learn a thing or two. Now, this week we have a very special episode for you where we look back at some of our favorite guests and give you parts of the conversations which didn't quite make the final cut, but we think need to be heard. So welcome to a very special episode of Friends of BWB. First up is our chat with Alan Simpson from episode 172, who was the managing director of London & Partners at the time of recording. And here we discuss the aftermath and implications of Brexit for London as a financial and tech hub.
Let's move on, but we'll just conclude on Brexit. So we're stuck with it, you think?
Yeah.
There's these two people who need to kind of make friends.
But here's the thing. I don't think it matters that profoundly.
Brexit underneath it.
So look, we've got offices around the world and we use those offices to bring investment to London, right? And there's been an interesting post-pandemic trend that before the pandemic, you knock on the door, hello, have you considered bringing your big tech company to London? Bloody hell, what have you done? No. Now, that is a second, third, fourth order problem because the pandemic's reset the geopolitics very profoundly, Ukraine as well. So Brexit is not at the top of the agenda. And there's this really, really interesting thing. So back in 2008, I remember during the pandemic, financial crisis, I was at the London Stock Exchange and we saw huge fundraising massive fundraising on the stock exchange, despite the fact that London had one of the worst financial crises of anywhere in the world. Why? Flight to safety. In 2018, we were seeing exciting tech companies, when we went and talked to them, said, do you want to come to London? Say, no, I'm going to go to Stockholm, I'm going to go to Helsinki, I'm going to go to Tel Aviv, because they were the frontier places and these people see themselves as cool. Now, those same people are saying, I'm going to go to London because there's enough risk in the global economy that I'm not taking a risk on my expansion. I'm going to go blue chip, and London is blue chip. So interestingly, I'm not
going to... What do you mean London is blue chip? The underpinning, the
London
city is oil.
Yeah, London has
banks.
Let's say you're a fintech. London has... if you're B2B, they've got banks to sell to. We've got the regulatory sandbox. We've got early adopting
blue chip,
customers.
All the potential customers, top
everything
top
about
shop.
The UK is blue chip. So people are de-risking and they're coming here for safety in the same way that in 2008, despite the fact that we were ground zero for the financial crisis, people still came here to raise
money.
If we
sort our politics out a bit, I mean, you know, at least Sunak's probably the best of these leaders, and then let's get Labour in and let... I mean, he is, probably. I don't know. This clever, you know, someone... And it hasn't been in the press.
Is he, though?
Well, I don't know. It sounds like vaguely people are making more friends than they were before. So I'm just saying, that's shit, yeah? And yeah. I'm not sure Labour are going to save the planet. Who knows? Maybe they will. I'm a Liberal. No one vote Liberal, you know? I don't know who's
in charge. Nobody wants to vote for the losing party, man. My secret hope is that Keir Starmer is slightly disingenuous.
Drunk and comes around my...
No. Well, there is that. No.
It's a lovely head of hair.
Oh, it's just
as
gorgeous,
we
man.
Previously established, Ed Balls is my go-to. Anyway. Sorry.
See, I mean, that's niche.
Yeah, it's niche.
I mean, it's the name. Never pick a man called Ed Balls. I've got one last question. Oh,
no,
sorry, you're fishing.
What I was going to say is my secret hope is that Labour get in and then they say, did we not mention we're just going to rejoin the common market?
Yeah, they should just... I think you can rejoin the constituency.
Like,
but
surprise!
Get my balls. Like, you know, someone should just be like...
But why would you... Genuine question. Why would you want to be part of the customs union but not part of the EU?
Because it's the only way back at the moment to just keep life simple. Let's be Iceland. I deal a lot with Iceland. The main problem is we want free movement of people again, you know?
But free movement without the other freedoms not
going
to happen.
Yeah, but you get the three freedoms.
So the difference between the UK and us is between the UK and the smaller... what I'm going to call peripheral countries around the EU, is the scale of our market means that the Europe is not going to give us the same deal as they've given the others.
So the
assumption, the underlying assumption, if you're a kind of libertarian of Brexit, was not the same one as those somewhere, as I've described, it was that you reclaim your regulator, your sovereignty, and they don't mean sovereignty in a kind of flag-waving way, they mean the ability to re-regulate, and we make ourselves Singapore on Thames.
Yeah. We get now, of rid course, of all regulation, basically.
Yeah, but
which
the thing
Martin
is,
Wolf thinks is our best shot, but he doesn't think it's good enough.
Well, one, Singapore is actually not what people think it is. You know, they have more social housing than anywhere in the world. It's quite interventionist. Two, you could only spend sovereignty once. Right. So if we want to do a trade deal with someone and we set our regulation against them, we can't then set it somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's like trying to cover a double bed with a single duvet. You know, if we pull our regulation off towards the US, yeah, we lose access to the EU. If we pull it towards the EU, we're less competitive against the US. Yeah. So the idea that you can pull out the EU and then just randomly, no, that's not how it works. You know, sovereignty is a finite resource. You spend it well.
Yeah, okay, because you've got they're just a whole overlaying of contracts you've got with other people. It's a bit like as a tax advisor, when Brexit happened, they were like, what happened? It's like, well, actually, the tax, all the contracts are between each country, and there's thousands of laws.
And also, and I know you want to move on, but also the thing which is misunderstood is that, one, if you look at regulations like MiFID, AIFMD, all of these big regulations that sort of define financial services, for example, they're basically written by British lawyers, for one thing. Mm. Two, when a lot of that regulation came into the UK, we then gold-plated it with our own stuff. The problem isn't that we're being forced to abide by like a French regulatory standard. Our standard is higher. Mm-hmm. Our standard is higher. So, and you look at something like bank ring fencing in the UK, that was a UK decision. The EU equivalent, Liikanen, never happened. So the idea that the UK midpoint of regulatory law is somehow more libertarian than Europe is simply not true.
Yeah, it's not true.
In fact, there was
a very famous case when it was the last time the establishment shut down the press, because back in the late 60s, or it must have been mid-70s, early, late 70s, because we joined the EU in 73, the press had the power back then, the establishment as it were, that if they wanted to blackwash your story or not let something get out. And I think it's the Daily Telegraph at the time, and they went to the European Court as one of the first cases. And so freedom of the press in this country comes from the European Court, because they overruled the British Court's decision, which was a bit bent, basically, because it was you have to look up the case. It's famous, and I've described
it
bad.
I haven't really been following this, but what happened to the bill that was going through Parliament, you know, that was colloquially called the bonfire of legislation.
Yeah. So we ported all the European law across in the acquis. So the acquis communautaire, the body of European law, just got kind of ported across. And there has been an attempt to go through it and sort it out. But the problem is it is hellishly complicated. So just let's take something like the European definition of SME. Simple. The amount of law that points to that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And of course, as you know, some of that says, you know, just literally points to that piece of legislation. Some of it just quotes it.
Yeah.
Well, great, but you've got to go and find all of that. So, no, I mean, it's not very far along.
Up next is our chat with Victoria Jenkins from episode 275, who is an award-winning adaptive designer, entrepreneur, speaker, writer, and founder of the Unhidden clothing brand. And here we discuss the very sensitive topic of disability representation and the correct use of language.
It feels a little bit like, you know, disabilities, we need to be told how to feel about it by people with disabilities. A bit like, as I said to a black friend about, you know, Black Lives Matter, I don't feel I can comment on it. And he says, you're right, you can't.
Yeah.
But you're supposed to just listen. The thing is, it's very obvious if you're black or not.
Mm.
And what we're saying with disabilities is 1,000,000,000 types of this and all levels. And I have a right to tell people about tinnitus or ADHD, but these are not big issues, I don't think, you know. And therefore, but at the other end of the scale, people with heavy disabilities have very complex views on it. So I think people should talk, the people who know what they're talking about should talk about it.
Yeah, again, it's the same, just listen. And, you know, I mean, I know, and I've just got so used to it when I get out, you know, I can see if I say I'm disabled, I can see someone's brain just going, how, why, where what, I can't see it.
Yeah.
And I know it doesn't matter what the rest of half hour of what I'm saying is, that's all they're thinking about. So I have to address it early on, because I'm like, otherwise they're not going to listen to a word of what I say. They also don't understand why it's relevant and why I'm talking about it. And that also will go on in their brain on a little loop but she's not disabled. I can't see her disability. What's going on?
She's fine.
Yeah, she's fine. She's making it up. She's faking, God forbid. So I don't mind doing it.
Well, it's like chronic fatigue syndrome, isn't it? You know, stuff that's completely, you can't see it. Well, that's a disability,
well,
isn't it?
Well, it is. Sorry, I thought you were going to say it's not a thing. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to throw things at you.
Oh, right.
Because that is so amazed. Many people's like attitude to that, and
well,
and
syndromes
and
are hard ones, they are. Because they're always like, you know, it's they they're badly, but it's definitely.
But you
a
know,
thing.
But you can't, yeah, exactly. But it's just I think just being open to listening and slightly changing that perception that disability one obviously doesn't look a certain way, but that it's not just wheelchair users, it's not just ramps.
You know, probably in the future, because we're almost there already, I mean, we'll all be wearing specs that can do things. In the future, it should be able to take a face ID and just give you a little like, you know, this they suffer from this, to be aware.
Oh, no, not suffer. Well, I don't know.
Okay,
suffer
wrong
from
word.
Either. They live with.
Jesus, it's complicated.
It is, isn't it,
I mean,
right?
That's why don't we talk about it? And then you're like, you know, it's in like, we're not being represented.
But
it's like, but every word I say, I get shouted at.
No, but I'm not shouting. I mean, I'm saying, so, you know, the
no,
next
you're
time,
not. But I'm just saying, we're all terrified.
I know, and it is terrifying, you know, and I still, there are times when I've said it wrong and been like, oh, damn it, I said that wrong. I think you just have to accept, going to get it wrong. I'm going to say it wrong. Language is going to change. Like, what, you know, like handicapped used to be an acceptable word, definitely isn't now, depending on the age of the person.
You can't
like,
say handicapped.
No.
What? Because
well,
it sounds bad.
Well, yeah, it's like
disability
saying,
sounds the same to handicap
disabled,
in my brain.
But disability on its own isn't bad. It's how we treat it that's bad. It's the social model. Like if we, the medical model of disability is that disability is bad. The social model is that we're
but
disabled by...
But handicap's meaning is you're unable to do certain things. That's the definition. It's the same as disabled, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, but it also makes out maybe that you can't, you know, if, well, that, or there's like handicapable. Or, you know, you know, differently abled, which makes me want to die. Because you don't say like differently gay, do you? Like you don't say differently human. We like it's one of those things. It's a euphemism usually to make non-disabled people feel better.
It is a minefield.
It is, but you know, that's why I think it's good that all these conversations
just
are happening.
Don't talk about it if you're not disabled, but you
well,
probably
no, I think
are.
Just listen and, like, you know, take on different views. And we don't all agree on all of this either. Like, some people have no problem with certain phrases and other people vehemently
hate well, what
them.
I would ask, therefore, not from you, but what we therefore need to be is very understanding when they get it wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it is at a level, if I say the wrong black word, that people would, like, get angry with me. And, like,
but then
and they got so much anger built up and you're like, just correct me. Just if it's not how to say
exactly,
it.
But it must
it's
be
not,
trying if it's your whole life.
Yeah, and if it's every day, life.
Sure,
someone,
but you can't
you know, like
shout
people
at someone.
Touching your wheelchair all the time, and you know, like
do
all
they?
The fist,
is that
oh,
a thing?
They do. Yeah, you shouldn't. It's like touching someone's body. You don't do it, and you certainly don't assume that you.
They do it with dogs too. Interestingly,
yes.
And
well, they're also with guide dogs, which is a huge
you're not
problem. New no. And honestly, I mean, the amount of events I've been at with people who have a guide dog, and they're like, "Oh, can I pet?" And they're like, "No." And I've watched people.
Oh,
go,
you shouldn't pet a guide dog.
Ever.
You shouldn't pet a guide dog.
No, they're working.
You need. We need to have this at school.
Yes, I agree.
Because this is not something we can knock out in half an hour.
No,
this is a whole term. This might be even a couple of years.
Yeah, and
you know,
it is actually also Disability History Month here in the UK right now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we need to. You know, I mean, the yeah. I mean, it's an absolute mindful. So no wonder we all run away from it. But thank you for trying to make it a bit more make sense. So I'm not touching the wheelchair. I'm not mentioning it. I'm not using
not
any word. But I can use disabled because apparently that's cool.
Yeah.
So I could say, oh, you're disabled. Because I'd be scared to say that. I had a guy.
Oh,
I
you could just ask someone, you know, how do you like to refer to yourself? And because some people like person with a disability. They want to see the person first. And other people are disabled person. So yeah, it is a minefield.
Gosh, that's
why
very
I always
nuanced.
Ask. Yes.
Call them
is.
Tony. Use their name.
Yeah.
It helps.
Maybe just,
what's
yeah.
your name?
Yeah, do you need to, you know, because you don't necessarily
should you offer to help a disabled person?
Only if they... Well, generally, only if you can really see that they're having trouble. Otherwise, no. Like, if they're just doing their shopping, they're doing their shopping. They know how to do their shopping. You don't need to interrupt them. But if you can see, you know, if they can't reach something or if...
They need a bit of a push up the hill.
Well, no, you'd ask. Just say, like, do you need any help? And if they say no, and even if they say it rudely or not rudely, you just take that and off you go. You don't then start a fight with them because that happens
a
lot too.
I have to ask people a lot in supermarkets to reach things down from the shelves because
lovely.
I'm a short ass, right?
Yeah.
And people look at you so weirdly when you say, because you look for the tallest person that's in the row and then you say, excuse me, could you just do me a favour? I really need one of those.
Do you know what's happening to that tall person? Say, oh, not again.
Yeah. I've been discriminated
it,
against.
It is a disability being too tall. That must be one.
Yeah, generally it is actually.
6'5" or above.
Yeah, it's
because
a nightmare.
Because Hayden who works
on airplanes
is
and bed lengths.
Nine
and all sorts.
Or ten.
Yeah, it's
they talk about it all the time to him. I remember watching the
British tallest person.
I do feel like
he
and I are a different species because like it goes on forever.
Well, you shouldn't say things like that. No. It's offensive. No, no. Exactly. And I watched this the tallest man in Britain, and they followed him around. And he's quite at the time he was sort of in his 30s, and he would get furious at people because lots of people would you'd walk past in the street. Is your dick as big as you and stuff like that?
My God. Yeah,
and then he'd say yeah, and I'll beat you with it in a minute.
That would be offensive to anyone. Like
the people think it's okay to say all these crazy shit, but the most common thing is, my God, you're tall. It's very offensive. It's like
well, as if they're not aware. Yeah, oh, I didn't know that. Thanks for reminding me.
Well, apart from I don't mind people pointing out I'm short, because I am.
Well, you definitely can't for a man. It's okay for a woman.
Oh, I see. If you had an exceptionally
tall woman, I think she probably gets more comments than...
Maybe, but to be a small man is a huge disadvantage in life. Different. You will struggle to find a partner. You will struggle to get a job. You know, I saw a guy walking on the street and I don't know. It's so hard to hide it.
And now a quick word from our sponsor.
Business Without Bullshit is brought to you by Ori Clark, straight-talking financial and legal advice since 1935. You can find us at OriClark.com.
Up next is our chat with rebel economist, professor and award-winning author Steve Keen from episode 176, where we debunk economic norms and private debt and break down the modern monetary theory.
Is it really infuriating, though? To keep saying these
incredibly
things.
Incredibly infuriating, because you just, when you see the saying, there's a cliff, you're going straight towards a cliff.
Stop being
There's a cliff. Hi, how's it at the bottom of the cliff? You know, here we go again. I'm feeling the way I felt about the financial crisis, now I'm feeling about climate change for exactly the same reason.
Yeah, and when did you predict 2008, it all went bananas? Yeah.
The starting date of the crisis is actually August 14, 2007. That's the day we're speaking of the France. This is the day the Banque Nationale de Paris shut down three of its accounts, they stopped withdrawals from three of their accounts, which were linked into the subprime market. They simply couldn't evaluation. So that was the shock that began the whole thing. And I started warning of it in December of 2005.
Oh, wow.
Quite circumstantial as to why it was then. But I'd say December 23 was my first warning of the coming crisis.
Well, I've just watched the thing on Madoff, and you know...
Isn't it a great name? You're talking about my name being good. Bernie Madoff with the money.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought... And you know, this
only
is...
Only an American
pattern.
Could get away with a name like that and be taken seriously.
There's a pattern, though. Whatever your name is, you tend to be. There is this sort of, you know, you do... I mean, in the right... But that is amazing, because in that, you've got a guy who dedicates his life... who's a mathematical genius working in some serious fund to writing letters to the FCA or equivalent.
Yeah, trying to break in and prove that he's wrong.
Is it FCA? I can't remember what they're called in America. Yeah,
and whistleblower.
He writes again and again and again and again and again and again, and they interview him a lot in the documentary. Yeah. You know, very serious, geeky kind of guy. He was like, he just did the basic statement, which is exactly what a friend of mine, who will remain nameless, said to me the other day. Yeah. You know, he's a bit of a geezer. And he said, oh, look, Lenny, I've got this fantastic, I'll be getting
What accent is that?
East London is supposed to be. Anyway.
Oh, right, okay, because it sounded Australian.
Yeah, did it? Well, they have this commonality. Anyway, but the point was, there's a lot of these things flying around. They give you 10% returns, you know, in cash back, and they give it every year. And if you invite other people, it's a Ponzi scheme.
Absolutely.
I just said to him, and he's a really smart, white, streetwise guy. And I'm like, you know this is bullshit, man.
Yep.
You must know it's bullshit. And and he's like, well, I'm not doing anything. I'm getting the money. I'm like, you are. You're actually breaking the law. You're promoting an illegal financial product, you know.
And you're fucking over somebody else. You may not know them, but there is definitely
somebody at the end of that pile that's going to get fucked. Somebody thinks they've got a huge amount of money and they ain't, and they're going to find out the hard way at some point when it matters to them.
I think it's the fact that he believes it. And I've had to check with other people. So in FX, it's always an FX thing. Oh, we do FX. And if you ask people who are FX traders, making 10% a year, yeah, totally, you can do that. But not in a consistent manner.
Not every year.
Bernie
never had a negative year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
until he ended up in jail.
What did you think of the film? Should have started this question.
The Big Short.
Yeah, The Big Short.
Funnily enough, I met everybody in The Big Short before I saw The Big Short. And I got home and I found that I had an email from Michael Burry, which I managed to miss.
Aaron Sorkin?
I met them all.
I was going to ask you that.
Oh,
ages
God.
Ago.
I forgot.
They must have so lucky. You consulted you, did they? Did they interview you or consult you?
No, they did reading my analysis and said I got it spot on. And They wanted to meet me. This was a trip in New York, I think in about 2010 or 2011. I met them all before the movie came out. And then I got back home and I found I'd missed an email from Michael Burry. He was the guy who managed to short all this stuff and make an absolute fortune. So they're all following my work at the time.
Oh, the guy who was the drummer, the guy who was played by Christian Bale.
Yes, Christian Bale's character, yeah.
Yeah, wow, he was a fascinating character. What was the clue? Why did you suddenly think there's something wrong? What was it, just to finish off on 2008?
Well, I've always been a non-orthodox economist for 50 years.
What does that even mean? That just means I don't follow...
Your business without bullshit, okay, economics without bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Neoclassical economics is full of bullshit, and I sort of threw it when I was 18 years old. Circumstantial as to why I did, but I did. So I was looking around for explanations that made sense. And on one side, you had all these what are called neoclassical economists who've got this Panglossian view about capitalism and the future, and it's always going to be rosy and get better and nothing will ever go bad type thinking. On the other extreme, you get these Marxist types, and I say types because they're not strictly Marxists, who come out and say capitalism has a tendency towards depression. And I thought, well, that's bullshit too, because what I was seeing was booms. I wasn't seeing slumps and stagnation. I was seeing booms and collapses. And then in 1987, which is a good year to do it, I read Hyman Minsky. And Minsky had what he called the financial instability hypothesis, which is his explanation for where bubbles come from. And a punchline in his actual argument was to say that it follows that the fundamental instability of capitalism is upwards. The tendency to turn a stable, tranquil growth into a speculative boom is the fundamental instability of a capitalist economy. I thought that's spot on.
Yeah.
That nails it. But he tried to do a mathematical model of it back when he did his PhD in the 50s. And I knew the mathematical model he used as the foundation was the wrong model. And I also knew a better foundation. So I said, well, that's what I'll do with my PhD. And I built a mathematical model of his model of verbal model of financial instability. So that was what identified it. And an essential part of that model was something that neoclassical economists said doesn't matter, okay, private debt. So according to conventional economic theory, private debt is just an exchange of spending power from one person to another. If you lend money to somebody, the person you lend it to has got more spending power. If you repay it, the person who did the lending has more spending power. They cancel each other out. That's the garbage that Bernanke got the Nobel Prize for last year. That's garbage. When a bank lends money, it creates spending power. So the level of private debt and the rate of growth of private debt is what gives you credit. It gives you a stimulus for the economy, and that credit is part of aggregate demand and income. And I've proven that mathematically as well.
Part of the overall demand is created by the fact that loaning people, creating debt in the economy drives more growth.
Because
people spend money.
But people, the thing is, when you borrow, you don't borrow for the sheer pleasure of being in debt, okay? No. You borrow to spend. So if you borrow money, you spend it straight away. And then that becomes your expenditure and somebody else's income includes the change in debt. And the mainstream haven't worked that out. They will never work it out, but I did. And so my intellectual model was said that a rising level of private debt to GDP, if it is a sign of a potential crisis in the future, because that can't go on forever. It's a form of a Ponzi scheme. So that was my mathematical model, showed private debt could cause chaotic outcomes in the model.
The bit that always bugs me too is it's not this one-to-one ratio. It's this sort of leverage, you know, lending it. Is that why the economic... That's what creates the sort of growth, is it? If they lent it once every time, it would be okay, would it?
Every time when you lend, the change in debt, which I call credit, so debt's the amount of money you owe, credit's the new money you borrow that year or the bank lends you that year. Mm. So credit can be a huge part of total demand. Like in America's case, when the crisis hit, credit was equal to 15% of GDP. So the increase in debt in 2007 was equivalent to a 15% of America's GDP. Then credit can go negative. Okay? All the other forms of aggregate demand can go up or down, but they can't go negative. Credit can go negative. So it went from plus 15% to minus 5%. Between 2007 and 2010, which is like a 20% of GDP.
Credit can go negative, meaning that
you pay debt back.
Yeah, great. Yo, it's time.
And you don't borrow anymore.
It's time. We need more money in. It's the right that the bank have payment on demand if they want.
That's right.
They need the money back.
And also, if you pay, like when you, rather than spending the money, income you earn, you use to pay your debt down. That's subtracting from demand. So you go from positive to negative, and that's what caused the crisis. And I do, you know, the usual correlation coefficients and stuff like that between unemployment and credit. And I get correlation coefficients of minus 0.9. And according to economic theory, it should be zero.
Yeah, okay. You know?
Minus 0.9, slightly significantly different than zero. Okay.
Yeah.
But they won't even listen to it. They don't look at it. But that's what I looked at. And I looked at the data, long story as to why I did, in both Australia and America, which are the only countries I could get data for back in 2005. And I saw this exponential increase in the debt ratio. And I said, that can't go on forever. The debt ratio now is the highest it's been since the Second World War. It has to reverse. When it reverses, there'll be a crisis. That was the logic.
Okay.
And it worked out perfectly.
And so you're seeing another crisis coming over the hill?
Not so much now, because like to have a crisis like that, you've got to have a high level of credit in the first place. Because if you don't have a high level of credit, then going from positive to negative isn't much of a change. Yeah. Okay, so we went from plus 15 to minus 5. That's big. Yeah. Okay, this time we had a huge boost in credit during COVID, in the early periods of COVID, but that's largely been reversed, and credit is a smaller component of demand now than it was back in 2006. So I don't expect a crisis coming out of that, but I think we're going to see stuff coming out of climate change.
And just to conclude our economics chat, we move on to maybe some stupider things. But what do you think of modern monetary theory then?
Modern monetary theory is an absolutely accurate description of the accounting of a domestic monetary system.
Right.
That's what it starts from. There are, when it gets onto things like a policy, like a job guarantee, or it talks about foreign trade, I completely disagree with them on foreign trade. Okay.
What's their point on foreign trade?
They argue that exports are a cost and imports are a benefit. Right. So they actually, in effect, argue in favour of trade deficits.
Bonkers.
I agree. Okay. And I'm happy to say.
You've got
to
be good at making shit. People need to want
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
You know.
I mean, and there's a whole lot of. So this comes back to where modern monetary theory came from. And it came from a guy who's a very, very nice bloke, very intelligent, who's a trader. And some of his arguments were how a trader would see the monetary system. So he began from saying, governments don't tax to spend, they spend to tax.
Yeah.
Now, he was 100% correct on that idea. Yeah. And that's where the accounting side of it came from. But on the other side, he also said exports are a cost and imports are a benefit. Now, I would have gone, said, Warren, that's nonsense. I'm sorry, mate, you got that one wrong. Okay, but the two got bundled together. So people who push in favour of the accounting side, which is 100% accurate, also say it's a good idea to run a trade deficit.
Imports are a cost, exports are income.
Exactly, because when you
that's a pretty big difference.
Exactly, yeah. And that's been left out of their logic. So
the other one is the belief that governments should continue in a recession, governments should continue to spend and people should be, and I like this idea as principle, community service, people should be cleaning the roads, doing, you know, whatever it is. And that's the way you keep people working, so people never fall out of work, and then when it picks up, they go back into the private sector. I love the idea, but people are not that nimble. People don't change jobs,
Well, partly you don't change jobs because you're afraid of being unemployed.
Yes.
I mean, so that's actually an argument in favour of some sort of flaw, like a universal basic income or a job guarantee, meaning you can afford to lose your job you're in because you've got another one while you look for something else which is better. So that's, you know, that the fact that you provide a minimum for people means you can afford to leave where you are. You're not trapped. So there's a positive side on that particular front. But the thing they say about government spending is 100% accurate. And I've built a software package called Minsky, which is designed to actually model this sort of stuff. And they say the government doesn't tax to spend, it spends to tax. And what they're saying is if the government spends more than it taxes you, then it's putting more money in people's private bank accounts than it's taking out of private bank accounts. Okay, so it's creating the money there. Now, people think it borrows the money, do that, and that's really bad. It doesn't borrow, it sells bonds.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
And the bonds are bought by banks in the first instance, and the banks buy the bonds using the reserves that have been created by the money put into people's deposit accounts.
So trippy. It's so trippy when you say it beautifully, yeah.
So in that front, that side of it is completely accounting. The government should... We live in an economy which is a mixture of a fiat economy system where money is created by government fiat and a credit system where it's created by private debt. And you need both of them. Now, if the fiat sector makes the stupid mistake of believing it shouldn't run a deficit, then it doesn't create money, and it means people end up borrowing more money from the private banks. And when they borrow from the private banks, what do? They gamble on house prices,
yep.
or they gamble on share prices, or they gamble on NFTs, et cetera, et cetera. And you get a speculative world coming out of that rather than when people are selling and making real things. So the government should run a deficit. Almost all of the time, should run a deficit.
Just like a company should have debt, you know?
Debt's functional for a company. I mean, debt, and this is one of my great mates, and there's a guy with a wonderful name, Richard Vague. He's the least... okay.
Brilliant.
We want to produce a book together. Keen and Vague. Okay?
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Keenly Vague.
Richard is he won't tell me how much he's worth, but he's definitely a billionaire. And Richard ran two major credit card companies in America. Okay, so he knows his stuff extremely well. And his analysis shows that all our crises have been caused by private debt bubbles bursting.
Right.
Okay, and that's what we should be focusing upon. And mainstream economics tells us to ignore private debt. And that's why we have financial crises.
Who's telling us to ignore private debt? The mainstream economics?
Well, Ben Bernanke, for one.
Right, okay.
Paul Krugman.
Yeah, okay. And they're mainstream that they're listened to by governments closely.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the Neil Parker was very sensible on how they shouldn't put interest rates because this is a supply problem. This isn't the inflation is to do with supply issues. And he says the Bank of England is going to keep putting them up. And he's been right. They're going to keep putting them up until they get to about 4%, which is where they are now. And then
it's all going to come tumbling down again.
And they're going to think, oh, it's not really working, you know, or what are we
going to do? Or it's coming down anyway for independent reasons.
Exactly, it's coming down anyway for independent reasons. It must have worked, let's take them down again. But it's got fuck...
They've got a model which is as accurate a model of the economy as Ptolemy's model of the solar system or the universe.
Or my map of my brain, you know.
I wasn't going to talk about that.
It
fits the data and it's completely wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. So that's the people, that's why they make the huge mistakes. That's why they don't see financial crises coming, why they put interest rates up when it's not wage rises, which are causing inflation. Okay. So they've got a wrong model, and you're going to make wrong decisions about how to manage the real world.
And our final chat is with author and commentator around economics and politics, Grace Blakely, from episode 210, where we discuss alternative community-based economic models and the European economic dilemma.
Martin Wolf made this great point because he was saying the problem is when you look at it as a politician for bang for buck, the reason that London gets so much expenditure and gets Crossrail is so incredibly wealthy. It is one of the wealthiest areas in Europe. Southeast of England is a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. It has huge disparity, but it is a powerhouse. So you say, we spend a pound, we're going to get £100 back. You do that up north and the maths isn't very good. But your local council would be so much better to say, okay, we spread the money out, you work it out. And I think that happens, you know, like Yorkshire has a great identity or Newcastle has a great
identity. Wales does it very well. Yeah.
You know, Scotland's doing its thing, you know, in various directions. I never, you know, it's for
but
me.
But part of the reason that doesn't happen here is because we're so centralised politically and economically. And it becomes a self-reinforcing cycle for all the reasons that you've just said.
It's good and bad thing. Yeah. It has its pluses, the centralization. But yeah, I mean it's the sort of, you know, can they spend the money in the right way, isn't it? And sort of, you know, cock it up or not, I guess, you know.
But again, I think that comes down to how do you engage people in their communities. Another example of this is community budgeting. This is tried first in Brazil, actually. And basically, the local governments in Brazil were given a certain amount of money. They just gave it over to the community and said, what do you want to spend this on? Unsurprisingly, it ends up going on things that make a huge difference. So on education, on, you know, local infrastructure, community development, it reduces poverty, reduces inequality, has all these amazing side effects that you wouldn't even expect. Really also kind of boosts people's sense of participation, people's sense of kind of power and engagement within the system. And, you know, all you have to do is take 20% of the municipal budget and say, let's decide what we want to do on this democratically.
What, to make me understand, don't councils get given their money to work out what to do with the money? It's only a small amount of money, is it, a council gets?
Yeah, it's been cut so much. So local councils were actually the part of the state that were most affected by austerity.
Right.
I think it was over the 10 years, they had about 40% of their central government grants cut. And then they were told, right, well, you can raise all the rest from business rates. But of course, that's massively, it's a huge disparity. If you're in central London, if you've got business rates income, great. If if you're in, you know, a rural area.
Preston.
Exactly.
Or,
yeah, yeah, it's a lot harder. So we've actually made it more unequal over the
so hard
last
to try anything
years.
Out there. I mean, I joke, it's like we need to take the Isle of Man, Isle of Wight, and just start experimenting on
oh
them.
My
you know
God,
what I mean?
They are so weird. Bro.
Yeah, well,
I mean, you don't want to start with
well,
the weird
Well, the Preston
bits.
Example, what was that? That was just an experiment.
What happened was that they basically were nearly bankrupt. So the whole idea was that they had this regeneration.
Preston Council.
Yeah, they had this regeneration plan where they were going to get, I think it was a few big businesses. I feel like Marks and Spencer's or something, and that to build this new shopping mall, and it was going to be the part of this, you know, development project. And then they pulled out, so they found themselves in the situation of just like, oh dear. They then engaged this a couple of think tanks who had been working with Detroit in the US, where yeah. they've been doing this, obviously, you know,
yeah,
really,
yeah.
really
terribly
disadvantaged.
Deprived,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that was where this idea of community wealth building came in. They tried it, it worked, and it became this big part of Labour's strategy for local councils. It's gone now. You know, unsurprisingly, because it was just like anything that was in the 2019 manifesto is now out, regardless of whether or not it's yeah. based on something good, which is a shame because, you know, that's something that I think so many people could get on board with, really.
Yeah, it's it certainly makes sense, you know, to give, like, and then maybe people would pay a bit more attention to who they're voting in locally,
yeah.
I guess. I mean, I always fall back again, though, to, you know, and that's what this local idea illustrates, is that I struggle with us voting on the plan as opposed to voting on the people, like the
yeah.
people. You told me that's the Greeks used to do it. It's like, I take any subject, you know, we all three of us would have to go away for weeks studying it to have even the remotest sense of what this subject really meant. You know, we cannot do it from headlines. And so therefore you want the cleverest, broadest group of people. Maybe you need some dumb people. You need some real dissection of society, a lot of time, give them some space, let them work on a problem and come. And then if they can do it at a
Which
local
arguably
level,
is what
all
democracy
the better.
Is, yeah. really.
We should be,
yeah.
but we're not. We sit
well, exactly.
with sound bites going, Richie Sumac's wife didn't pay tax.
Yeah.
Fuck all of the, I can never get it right.
Fucking hell.
I know.
Frishy.
All right. I'll write it down. But whatever the soundbite, you know, let's pick one. And what really pushes me over the edge is that journalists, rather than trying to break out the conversation,
yeah.
you know, they just take the soundbite and say, he's a racist or whatever. And it's like, what the fuck did he mean? He's an intelligent guy. He lives in London. I doubt it's that simple.
I think this is the thing that annoys me the most about... And I think it is actually the kind of society that we live in today. And I think you can trace a lot of this back to the changes that we saw in the 1980s, where it was all, we went from a kind of a society where we had a lot of things provided collectively. There were more kind of social, and there was, you know, a stronger kind of social fabric, through to a very individualized society where, you know, it's your house, your pension, your responsibility to build up your own wealth, to look after your family. Don't really care what anyone else is doing. You're not going to be part of a union. You're not going to really have a foot in your community. We think about ourselves and each other as individuals kind of bumping up against one another in this, like, unreal society, because as Thatcher said, there's no such thing as society. And it just encourages us to think about everything as an individual problem. What do we do about climate change? Change your shopping habits. You know, what do we do about, I don't know, democracy? You vote differently. What do we do about our tax affairs? You deal with your tax affairs. We just don't think about anything collectively, because none of us really are properly engaged in collective processes of decision-making where we could change those things
yeah,
at a social level.
What's the middle ground? And everyone always quotes Scandinavia, but you know, it's I don't know what the middle ground is to try and solve that. You're saying that we all need to become, I have time to get involved in my collective. My wife's
well,
on my wife's on next door all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
said, do you know what she said to me last night? I was going to sleep. A baby's taking a shit in the Lilo in Queen's Park. And I'm like, babe, you gotta get off fucking next door.
That's
the kind
hilarious.
Of chat. You know what I mean? Whereas next door probably should be about the community we have, but it's more like, I saw a guy with a knife.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And a baby took a shit. Well, I just have to ask this last question, maybe, and we'll make, keep it very brief, though. Europe as a whole is generally a bit more socialist in that attitude, and there's more of a sense of community and stuff, but you think the European experiment is not such a good plan? Yeah, quick 10-second question there.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to go into there. Look, I think, and especially when we were having this debate around the time of the referendum, there are a lot of issues with the way that the European kind of economic system works. And I mean, you obviously saw that during the debt crisis. And those
yeah.
problems, by the way, have not gone away. We are still seeing this
massive... Germany has this huge power.
Just this, yeah, this divergence between economies in the north and in the south. You have this single currency. The ones in the north are much more productive. They've had historically a lot more time and opportunity opportunity to invest in technologies that make their workforce more productive. Those in the South have not had that time.
Beach.
So, their economies are not as productive because they haven't had that history of being able to invest in the same way that the other countries have. So it makes, relatively speaking, their exports seem less competitive, which means you've got this constant pressure of divergence. And unless you are able to say people in the North need to be able to invest in the economies of the South to equalize those rates of productivity, that divergence is going to carry on forever until you either get to this system breaking up into two parts or you get some form of kind of budgetary centralization.
Do you not think you draw a map of the world and you look where the sun is, the hotter it is, the less productive it is. Is that not really what's going to drive it?
I don't think so.
If you look, you can literally go around the world. If it's fucking hot, people do less. Cold, people have to do more to keep busy almost.
Think that is overlain by the pattern of colonialism. So there are, Britain colonized a lot of the world. The places that British people settled and, often wiped out the native populations, got the advantages of huge amounts of British investment, got the ability to start entirely new countries basically and go from there. And often, in the US you had the advantage of being able to expand into the frontiers and all that sort of stuff. Whereas places that English people didn't like to live didn't have settler colonialism and so had a much more exploitative relationship.
We're going to have to move on.
I'd
love to display that more.
A big, big thank you for tuning in this week, and we'll be back with another episode very soon. Stay tuned.